The OTB Podcast Network with Pepsi Max, proud sponsor of the UEFA Champions League. For the love of it.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Time now for OTB Football Saturday. We are streaming across all of our social platforms and on the OTB Sports app. Just search OTB Sports in your app store if you don't already have it. And a reminder as well that all of our football coverage is brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunluie.net. Joining me for the next 2 hours, I have former Republic of Ireland international Damien Delaney, Daniel MacDonald, football correspondent of the Irish Independent, and freelance football writer David Snaid. How are we all doing, lads?
All good, Neil.
So we may as well jump in. Ireland-Ukraine last night. Myself and Will were saying in the news round, from probably halftime onwards, a bit of a Macedonia feel to it, Dan?
Yeah, I suppose. I'm trying to think what parallel you can make. They're not good comparisons in either way.
Unfortunately, yeah.
I mean, to be completely pedantic about it, the two Macedonians, one was like a 90-minute concession when the game was in control, and the other one was crazy. It was in a 3-2 with orange jerseys and Jason McAteer kung fu kicking around the place and whatnot. This was more like, it was more like an Ireland-Georgia game or something, you know, the sort of the slow death aspect of it. I think they've set a higher bar for themselves than to just get sort of patronizing coverage, if you know what I mean. They've given it their best and all. I mean, you can see it on their faces afterwards that they basically know that they've blown it from a position where they're, you know, their home performances have left them in a position of strength in that group. And I mean, you know, most of that team now are playing full time at a good level. You know, they're competing and around, you know, some of the top players in the world, basically, in women's football. And they're more than holding their own in terms of their company that they keep at club level. So in that context, they've really messed it up from a really strong position. It'll probably be something they'll carry with them for a while. I am conscious that, like, I guess we don't necessarily cover the women's team extensively, but I think it's noticeable. I certainly find, anyway, I think a lot more people genuinely are watching the games now and forming more opinions and sort of genuinely sort of starting to learn a bit more about the players. And as a result, there's probably a bit more comment and opinion around it. And it did seem quite strange to me last night that you're in a situation where you could see in the second half they were running out of ideas a small bit. And it was 85 minutes in before they made a change, which seemed to me like a slightly curious strategy to follow. And I've noticed, you know, people who follow the game closer, you know, speaking about maybe Amber Barrett, a forward player, you would have thought in that situation you try and make something happen because they had lost their way a bit in the second half. It's cost them. I mean, the goal was, you know, unfortunately, it was just a bit of a shocker, really. Like, and maybe just a couple of psychological blows in the first half that it was. I'm sure Damo has been involved in these games where it's just running away from you, and they couldn't turn it around.
Damien, we'll bring you in there. Anya O'Gorman under pressure for that goal, like, kind of dives in to flick the pass back towards her goalkeeper Courtney Brosnan. Brosnan misjudges it. Couldn't get her feet right. Ball goes into the back of the net. Like, it just shouldn't be happening. I saw there was a bit of debate going on Twitter last night, like a few of the ex kind of defenders clubs saying, you know, Anya O'Gorman should be playing that outside of the post. But I don't know, from my uneducated point of view, it looked like that was a position where, you know, it's a kind of a half tackle, half pass. You're kind of just getting in there to try to get the ball back in the general direction of your goalkeeper, are you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the best person to comment on that. Myself and Stephen just had a bit of a thing on Twitter last night. Yeah, look, mistakes happen. It's unfortunate, you know, but I think the Irish women have made such progress, you know, that we now expect to win games that we did last night. And it just wasn't to be, but sometimes that psychological hurdle you know, when you expect and you put yourself in a position where not only you expect, but everyone expects really you to get results, psychologically that can be hard just to climb that kind of final wall for the last time. And they'll have another opportunity at some point further up the road. And I'm sure once they make that kind of psychological step, that games like last night won't be the first time for a lot of those players.
Yeah, like from a player's point of view in that kind of a situation, Damien, like we would have seen it during the first half. First you have the own goal like that, for example. Then you have the penalty. You know, sorry, Katie McCabe hits the crossbar with a free kick before all of that. You have the own goal. Then they get the penalty. That comes back off the crossbar. What are those games like when you're kind of going in at half time and like Ireland had played the better stuff? They were definitely the better team. What's it like being in those situations where you just can't get it out of your head that things just aren't going for you today?
I always believe that in games like that is where you just take a deep breath and keep everybody calm, because it can get an element of where you like snatch at the result a little bit. You know it's there for you. You know you're playing well, and you just almost kind of get a little bit antsy and a bit agitated or a bit uptight maybe. And you snatch at it really, as opposed to just believing. But when it's your first time being in the position that I was talking about earlier, where you know you're expecting to win and you should be winning, the last bit is often very, very difficult. But once they make that step, then hopefully that'll become normal for them. Because you know, bearing in mind it might be the first time that a lot of those players were in the position, as Dan pointed out, where we were all expecting, as opposed to just kind of the plucky, we did our best and we were unlucky. And that brings a different type of pressure, and it's a different type of psychological aspect to deal with. And unfortunately, you can't teach that. You can't. It's just experience that next time, you know, they get themselves in a position, and it might be well up the road, to be honest with you, but the next time they get themselves in a position where it's win or bust. I remember the first time I was in that position, I was playing at Hull City, and we were playing Swindon Town at home to get promoted from League Two. And it was one of them ones where it was just, you know, we were, I think, 3 points clear with two games left, and it was the second last game of the season, and it was a case of just get a draw today. And you do feel like the emotion kind of gets involved, and you do find yourself running away with yourself. Like, we took the lead in the game, if I remember correctly, and then you do start watching the clock, and you get a little bit nervous, and then they equalise, and you kind of lose focus, lose concentration, and you get ahead of yourself. It's just important to stay in the moment. Stay trusting in your coaches, stay trusting in each other and your teammates, and let the process come to you, as opposed, or let the kind of the result come to you, as opposed to snatching at it.
Guys, would they be a bit frustrated that they were playing against 11 players for three quarters of that game? Like, you had the penalty incident with Tanis O'Sullivan, defenders on a yellow card already. At any other point in the pitch, is that going to be a second yellow?
Yeah, look, I was thinking it should have been, like, I don't know, is it the double jeopardy thing of maybe giving sending a player off after you've given a penalty? But yeah, like, I thought maybe it was definitely a yellow card challenge anywhere else on the pitch, you know? And it's like what Damien and what Dan were saying there about the kind of the mental aspect. I think it was the moment that kind of sums up snatching at a moment. It was Rhianna Gerrit's chance. Like, she'd done so well to with the run and then working that space and then that shot. Like, that was the moment, even more so than the penalty. I was just sort of thinking, oh, I just don't think it's going to come for them if because I was expecting her to score in that position, you know. And it was frustration and it was disappointment. But one of the things that if you're trying to take positives from it is, if you go back to the previous manager before that, it always seemed very negative under Colin Bell, in the sense of not only just how he set up the team, but how he spoke about the players in the team. And it was almost as if, oh, we're only going to get one chance. We might only get one chance in the game and we have to score it. If there's one thing that Virta Pau has brought to this group of players, it is that kind of sense of going at teams and being able to create these chances. And it is the big thing, though, what's going to have to happen is just marrying it up with getting that result and getting that kind of the monkey off their back to get into a tournament.
Damien, like what David said there, does that actually play a part where a manager is speaking out before a game and talking about, like, oh, we're not going to get many chances, we need to take them as best we can? Like, does that put an idea into players that maybe they're not as good as they actually are?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I've played for managers before that would kind of put messages out in the press, because he knows that the players would read the press and they're kind of trying to plant the seeds subconsciously and stuff, and speaks to the players through the press. So the players do see it. You can't help but see it, you know, on Twitter or you get tagged in things, or if you walk into a news agent, you'll see the local paper and the headline that's there. So, like, when you see negative comments like that, it does have an effect on you, absolutely. You know, and when you get into the moments that, like, you were in last night where you had a chance to qualify, and if your mindset is quite negative, and I wouldn't be able to comment on the Colin Bell situation, but if what David said there is true, then, you know, when you get into those crunch or those clutch moments, if your mindset is a little bit negative or you're not sure of yourself, you're not 100% confident, that's why you will never qualify. And I suppose it's up to the manager to instill that confidence in the players, and Vera Pauw has almost certainly done that. And they have made strides, but it's just that last and final step, you know, qualifying for the major tournament.
Yeah, it certainly is. So what's coming up next? They've got one more game in the campaign. That's on the 1st of December. They're at home to Germany. They're 4 points clear of Ukraine at the moment, but Ukraine have a game in hand. So if Ukraine were to win both of those games, the first one against Greece in a couple of days and then against Montenegro, which is one they're certainly expected to win, that would mean Ireland would have to beat Germany in order to qualify for the playoffs. Dan, like, it looks like an incredibly tall order for Ireland to beat Germany, but in a few days' time, there's probably going to be all eyes on that Greece-Ukraine game.
Yeah, like, it's certainly the body language from people, and they talk about the way that people discuss the Germany game. And look at their stats. I mean, they're hammering everyone, Germany. So even Vera Pauw, like, the levels seem to be like women's football as a professional sort of sport is developing, you know, and it's almost like, you know, you see it's almost like the Rugby World Cup to a degree, you know, where you have sort of these beatings are almost expected, you know, and that these newer nations are trying to learn and catch up and develop and get there. But there almost seems to be an expectation that you're going to have that it really is like 18 out of 18 or 27 out of 27, whatever. They'll take maximum points. And even, like, basically they're putting a brave face on it, but it seems like they're really just expecting to lose to Germany, as much as you can't approach a game that way. But it's funny, Dave mentions the Colin Bell. I mean, probably his greatest triumph was that nil all away to Holland. Mm. But that was 11 players behind the ball for 90 minutes. Like, it was sort of unbelievable stuff, really. And it's probably not a way that you actually advance as a nation, really. But, like, you know, it gets you a great result on the day. It would need to be something similar unless, I mean, it is strange. I mean, like, Germany seems to be very, very professional about how they approach it. I don't know, is there a situation where they've already qualified that they send out, like, a second string team or something? But they're so strong, it seems like they can anyway. But even listen to Vera Pauw talk about Ukraine and Greece. I mean, Ukraine won the first game 4-0. They don't look to be that great, to be honest. But the feeling would be that Greece obviously are, you know, an inferior side. They do have home advantage as much as it counts in these times. But again, like, Vera Pauw wasn't holding out hope that there was going to be a Gary Mackay moment here, you know. Yeah. It just seems like, you know, the levels between teams are big enough so that it really would require quite a dramatic upset for something like that to happen.
It's kind of similar to Test rugby, I think, where there is an enormous gap between the really, really good teams and the emerging nations.
Yeah, I think so. I did cross the mind last night. And listen, you would think over time, as the sport grows and evolves, like, those gaps will close a bit. You know, that there is a sense that, I mean, we mentioned the number of Irish players that are full-time, and that wouldn't necessarily have been the case, you know, a decade ago in terms of the volume of players. So, like, it takes time. But to get a handle on it, like, it does seem like some of the other teams in the group are very, very limited. And it's harder. Like, it's really hard to, now, like, you know, so you talk about 11v11 and stuff, but, like, you're talking about the difference between, like, full-time and amateur, basically, in some of these games. And, in fact, that's basically the rugby parallel. Like, that's why you get the results that you do. And they don't seem to be madly optimistic. But, again, it seems like then the massive regret for Ireland is that they didn't win in Greece, even. You know, and if the feeling is that Greece are that poor, that they would not be able to lay a glove on Ukraine at all, then Ireland have to sort of reflect on how they managed to drop points there. And I think that's part of the post-mortem that seems to be coming around the corner for them, barring a pretty shocking Ukrainian collapse. I mean, they didn't look that good, Ukraine. I mean, they could have one of those days where they don't look like a sort of a free-scoring machine, albeit they have, you know, knocked four past Greece in a previous game. But it feels like Greece would have to adopt some of the Ukrainian tactics and, you know, frustrate them and sort of really take the life out of the game to get something from it. Because, but I'm going off Vera Powell's body language again. They don't seem to be very optimistic, do they?
No.
And I think as well, when you put it in context, I saw a tweet from Mark McCadden this morning, kind of putting in about Germany's record, that like in the last 20 years, they've like won 70 out of 72 World Cup and European qualifiers. So that kind of maybe explains just why they are so downbeat as well today.
Just want to quickly jump in. We have a goal in today's 3 o'clock Premier League game, Fulham against Crystal Palace. Good news, Damien Delaney, because Mike Lawrence has details.
Fulham 0, Crystal Palace 1. Jero Riederwald putting the visitors up front against the run of play. It has to be said, it was all Fulham in the opening exchanges, but Luka Milivojevic found Zaha. He found Riederwald, who fired it low under Areola to make it Fulham 0, Crystal Palace 1.
Guys, final thoughts before we move off the women's team here in last night's game. If results go as expected and Ireland miss out in a playoff spot, like coming into this campaign, the goal absolutely was getting into the playoffs or possibly even qualifying for the tournament. But missing out on that, like, what are the positives to take if they do miss out? Is it an enormous missed opportunity? Are there still positive signs of growth that can be built on for our next qualifying campaign?
I think so, yeah. I think to put yourself in a position where you could, potentially, you know, with a victory last night, could put yourself in a position for a playoff is probably as close as we've been, or we look closer than you know, Bernard might have been watching, the history of women's football in Ireland, but from what I'm seeing and what I've watched and what I've heard, you know, we're getting closer. So you have to, I mean, that's going to be of no comfort to the Irish players this morning when they wake up. They'll be obviously gutted and disappointed at what happened. But I think, you know, when the next campaign starts, if nothing comes of this one, you know, you've moved a step closer, and we just need to be patient and keep putting the building blocks and infrastructure in place. And eventually we will kind of get that monkey off our back and qualify for a major tournament.
And I suppose as well, when you look at the kind of the age profile of that team as well, you see like Heather Payne's performance yesterday. She's obviously like a standout. She's only in her early 20s. Denise O'Sullivan, who's a very, like, was one of the mainstays of that team, still only in mid-20s. Rhianna Jarrett has come back from, which is well known, obviously a couple of really serious injuries. Again, she's only in mid-20s. Katie McCabe too. So, like, it's not as if it was a chance. It was the sense of a team, or, well, this is a team who had been building towards this campaign, and they're all in their prime. Like, you would hope that there's still much more to come from that group of players, and especially under that manager too.
Yeah, okay, we'll take a quick break here, guys. 53106 for your text. Get your thoughts into us. We're going to be speaking a bit about Dundalk after the break. Also, Virgil van Dijk and the fallout of his injury. Manchester United's good week. Chelsea, Man United and Chelsea obviously playing later on. Arsenal and Mesut Ozil, still plenty to get through this afternoon. And just to remind you, Kerry cruising now towards the Division 1 title in the Allianz Football League to 15 to 10 points in front against Donegal with 12 minutes left to play at Austin Stack Park in Tralee. In the Premier League, Manchester City 1-1. They had a draw against West Ham earlier in the day. And as we heard from Selhurst Park, it's Crystal Palace 1-0. Or from Craven Cottage, it's Crystal Palace 1-0 up away to Fulham. So 53106 for your text. Get them into us and we'll be back in a few minutes.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Guys, turning back to OTB Football Saturday with Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent, David Snaid, football writer, and Damien Delaney, former Irish international as well. We might talk about Dundalk now and their 2-1 defeat against Malta in the Europa League the other night. I think personally the game turned on what happened with me, because just as I was Googling whether it was 570 or 590 grand for a win in the Europa League, Malta got their equaliser. So I'm putting my hands up. I'm at fault for all of this.
You take the blame.
Greedy guts.
Yeah, it's funny though. I think actually, like, the it's strange. Like, it's such a different club now, Dundalk, compared to 2016, that I'm not even sure if the win-loss financials are, like, you know, I'm not sure if they're sort of madly coming into people's minds in terms of, say, from the ownership side of things. I mean, it's actually the big money is the 3 million for getting there, or they've actually got 3.8 million already from Europe this year if you take in the Champions League and stuff. So they're guaranteed 3.8. So I mean, like, for for any League of Ireland club, of course. I mean, 600 grand, the guts of 600 grand is huge. I mean, it's like four or five times what you get for winning the league. But I guess the way that club is operating at the moment, it's a sort of a, I'm not sure if that's a massive thing to them, bizarrely enough. It is more, I think, about the just trying to make your mark in the group stages and to get some points on the board. Like, I think there's always been a degree of realism around what's achievable for them in this group. I mean, I think, it's different to 2016 in the sense that there was the big event and the occasion and the fans could go and stuff. This time, it's very much for the players testing themselves. It's a different type of experience. It's about, let's see how they can do. They have the new coaching management team, which is an incredible story where they've come from. But I think they know that it is going to be difficult for them to get points. And I think their frustration is that probably that, you know, the home game against Molder probably represented their best chance. And I know Damo was there. I watched back the game again after. I know he was talking, he was doing the Virgin commentary. And there was that sense, like, definitely that sense at half time that it was like, oh my, you know, this is really there for them. And even though Molde stepped up and deservedly won the game, I think ultimately, I think, you know, as professionals, that group will look at it and go, yeah, just could have maybe managed that situation a bit better. And I know that there's unsatisfactory elements to the preparation in terms of certainly fatigue and like I think if you're going to be a professional club in a European competition, like, you have to play your games in between. And in fairness, Dundalk did get their games called off around the early rounds to facilitate them getting through and getting that £3 million. They're just a small bit unlucky this time that the Derry game they had on Monday was actually to do with international call-ups a while back. And there is no doubt that if you're a League of Ireland club in Europe competing at group stage football, you need to be at your absolute maximum. And I suppose having 48 hours less prep than your opposition probably doesn't help. But I mean, they did rotate some of the players on Monday and they have a big squad. And I don't think that's just an excuse that stands alone. It's a factor, definitely. But I also just think themselves, they'll know. They just could have defended some of those situations a bit better. As much as Molder were dominant, they had two shots on target in the game, you know, and they scored them. So that's obviously a bit of a sickener. Yeah.
The unfortunate bit that of them competing in Europe and being a League of Ireland side is it's only when you play these games and you make these mistakes that you get to put them right the next time, and they don't play against opposition of Molder's quality every week. You know, so I remember when we first went in the Premier League, you make loads of mistakes, but you could put it right a few days later because, you know, and as you kind of figured out as you were going, you understood that even though you were in the game at half time, the opposition have the quality or the caliber to up the ante, and then you figure out how to deal with that. So the first couple of minutes of the second half, you recognize, okay, I've been here before, I've experienced this before, the ante's been upped, how do we just weather this storm? And the manager obviously knows as well in terms of making changes. Will a shape change help the team to kind of stem the flow that's coming their way? And definitely the first 50 minutes of the second half, you know, we said at the game that perhaps a change, the manager could have been a bit more proactive, but I suppose he was, you know, a little bit kind of hesitant or reluctant or wasn't 100% sure what he was going to do. But next time that happens, he'll know, because with his review of the game, but it's just unfortunate they only get six games, is it, Dan, in the Europa League?
Six games, three in a row, which is a good thing now, as in three Thursdays in a row is exactly what I'm sure by the third game, they'll be pretty attuned, like they'll be dying for more, as you say, Damo.
Yeah, but you see, it was 2016 was the last time they had it, and all the lessons that learned, players had moved on, and unfortunately, they might not be in the Europa League group stages next year. It's just, I know the players will be kicking themselves because if we could play this every week, we could learn and we could get better, because that's the only way you're going to get better is making mistakes and learning how to cope with situations better. So, look, lessons will be learned and they've got five more games to go. But I definitely think that the opportunity that they had the other night, Molder at home, is probably their best opportunity they were going to get, to be honest with you.
Let's talk about the good things from the performance, actually, just to bring that in. Because, Dan, one of the things you said at the start there, like, you know, this campaign probably more about making your mark on the competition as opposed to the money this time round compared to 2016. But for the first half of the game on Thursday night, like, it certainly looked like they were making their mark. They actually were really, really good I probably haven't seen them as much as other people would have over the course of the last year, year or two. But for me, it actually looked like that was as good as I've seen them play for quite a while.
Yeah, no, I think so. Like, I think, like, when you think about it, like 2011 and 2016, the two previous Irish clubs in the group stage, I mean, they were both league winners that year, Shamrock Rovers and Dundalk. And I actually think, even though they had fixture issues, both of them, I think the level they were playing at every week or so, every second week, every other week, probably even propelled them to stuff at home. Like, when you consider this time, I mean, Dundalk have been way off it this year, way off it. You know, they're going to finish at best probably a distant third now. And, like, unfortunately, I wish it was, but, like, our league isn't strong enough to have, like, a team that's not winning the league sort of regularly competing in group stage football. And, like, so it's like that performance, I think, the other night is probably above anything they've probably done, certainly this side of the break. They obviously had that brilliant game at Rovers earlier in the year. And the two teams then, like, the dog have been underperforming massively, like massively. And you watch it the other day and you see the team they're able to put out, like quite an experienced group of players still. Like, many of them have played like sort of 20, 30 games in Europe, albeit as they, like, you know, a lot of them qualifying games as opposed to maybe elite games. And you see them in the first half and think, yeah, they actually are, like, these are sort of decent professionals. They know what to do. They can compete. Like, they're never, I think there's sort of a naivety sometimes that our teams, like, that they're going to get hammered. Like, I've made this point before, that if you're a well-organized professional team, you can generally stay competitive in games. Now, of course, they might still have a very difficult day in Arsenal on Thursday. That can happen. But generally, if you're at it and you have a sort of a discipline and an organization, like, you can be competitive at a good level. But, like, they've been so poor this year. And actually, like, I sort of take a small bit of issue with some of the commentary around how they qualified. I know that they got a very favourable run in terms of two out of the three games they played. But I think the Sheriff away, like Sheriff Tiraspol now, the team they got past, have been in the group stages in recent memory. And there almost seems to be a tone that, well, anyone would have got them through, or maybe the previous management would have got them through. Like, I don't think that's the case. Like, I, from certainly speaking, people that were very much around the club, and players aren't going to come out and say stuff publicly because that's not really how they do things. But, like, they were at a very low ebb in August. I don't think things were great. There was behind-the-scenes stuff, which we've discussed in the show before, that I think was affecting things. And their performance levels were criminally bad for the squad they have. Like, they should not be in a battle for a European place in the League of Ireland. Like, they should be miles clear of that. And so I think, in fairness, that the new management team have done a very good job in terms of just getting everyone rowing in the right direction again, and showing that when that Dundalk team plays to their best, they actually should be up, like, around Shamrock Rovers and Bowes, not 14 points behind them. And if anything, it just exposes how bad they were, and how bad things must have been in July and August, that they could be so bad in the League of Ireland and yet 2 months later be playing like a really top side in Norway in the group stages and competing with them. If anything, it just exposes just how bad things must have been a couple of months back.
Certainly is. One thing you mentioned earlier on it as well, it was an empty Talla Stadium as well. This was something that we asked Shane Keegan, part of the Dundalk coaching ticket, and a good friend of the show as well. That's he was on OTBAM on he was on Off the Ball on Friday night late after the game, and he brought up the issue with the crowds as well.
The lack of crowds, do you feel that that's a factor? Like, this would have been such a big occasion in Talla. Stadium would have been packed. It may well have been forced to be in the Viva Stadium, and you would have had 30,000 people at this game. And when you get that lead, the noise and the momentum and the energy it brings, like, that wasn't there. It all just felt a bit flat, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you say when you get the goal, I'd say even more so. You know, you talk about the tiredness, and there was obvious tiredness kind of 10, 15 minutes into the second half, and Filippo himself has spoken about how maybe we just didn't quite get the changes made at the right time. But when you're absolutely flat out and you've got no energy, players will tell you that you know, having that, as you say, 30,000 roaring yawn, you know that feeling when the opposition have had a chance and they've missed it, and the home support kind of give you that kind of a G up of, okay, lads, we've got away with that, but let's rise it again, kind of a thing, and that can work. That does give you an extra maybe boost of energy levels that will keep you going for another 5 or 10 minutes. And to not have that is disappointing. But sure, look, you know, there's absolutely nothing in the world anybody can do about that.
And just before we play that video as well then, guys, a text in here from Liam in RD. Do we think Dundalk would have gone on to win that game with a crowd behind them? Obviously, it's a complete what if. But from your own experiences from being there in Tala on Thursday evening, did, I suppose, the flatness of the atmosphere in the ground, did that add anything to it, or sorry, remove anything from the experience of the game?
I think it has as a whole. Like, just obviously the crowd, there's some sort of like intangibles that happen. Shane mentioned it there, but it was the same. I was even thinking this just around some of the Hurling games. Like, there's moments in games where something happens in a match that the crowd feed off and then the players feed off, and it does can make such a difference. Obviously, Damien will know about that far more than us. It feels like that from when you're in the stands anyway. But just in terms of the game itself, if there's a moment that you're thinking, well, what would have happened? Like, Pat Hooban's disallowed goal, still, when you look back on it, like, I know it's the first game of the campaign, and maybe a lot more would be made of it if it was the last game, and Dundalk needed to win needed a point to get through. But like, that decision not to give that goal was just incredible. And that sticks in my mind as a real what if moment, because from that point, obviously, that would have been 1-0. If they had got the second, then like, you're talking 2-0, and you're wondering what would have happened with Mulder, because obviously they did step things up. But yeah, like, the lack of crowds, like, just from being at matches, like, there's a moment I remember earlier on when Rovers played AC Milan, and like, you're seeing young fellas standing on their dad's shoulders trying to see over partition fences to catch a glimpse of even just some of the Rovers players, and we're going in to watch the match, and you're just sickened looking at it. Like, you're like, this is just horrible the way this is happening now, that like, even people are going up to the stadiums and just to try and show a bit of support, catch a glimpse, and it's just horrible. It doesn't feel the same. And there's some games where the tempo and just everything about it just doesn't feel the same at all.
I mean, like, what's Damo? I'd be interested to know what Damo thinks, because like, there is almost, I wonder, is there two sides to it in some of the games that, like, you know, the Dock were quite patient at times in the early minutes, and sometimes you can have an impatient crowd that almost they could create a different type of energy as well, and lads actually start to panic and start to get rid of it. Whereas at times, like, I wonder, Damo, do you know, is there a different energy to the early minutes of these games with no crowds compared to what you might expect from your big game experiences?
It's kind of a moot point, really, talking about it. It's a fact. You know, there's no crowds there. Coming out afterwards and saying if we had a crowd, we would have won, you still got noses in front and we're winning 1-0. You know, the crowd has an effect. It makes the occasion more enjoyable, and it makes you as a player happier because there's people there watching it. But ultimately, the game is played on the pitch, and you know, if a referee's giving decisions against you, the crowd can get annoyed. But usually, not usually, in fact, it would be safe to say nearly every player is so focused on the game and what's happening in the four white lines that, you know, towards the end, it can help last couple of minutes when you're shelling balls forward. The crowd can almost get you going and stuff. But these are all things that were known beforehand, and we've been playing without crowds now for a long time. So, you know, it was almost like when the manager came out after as well, you know, talking about the fixture list. I don't understand why. I'm not a fan of that, you know, and I said this afterwards when we were doing the game. Like, have your moan up when the fixtures are made. Try and get people to change their mind. If people don't change their mind, then just accept it and get on with it. You know, the fixture pile-up isn't ideal. We all agree with it. But coming out afterwards and saying, oh, maybe we were tired, we didn't have the preparation time. You knew well in advance that this was happening, and you rotate your squad, and Dundalk do have a massive squad. But these are all peripheral issues. The fan side of it would have been fantastic. It would have been brilliant for people to go there and watch a European game, and maybe it might have had a slight effect. But ultimately, Mulder came out the second half, a completely different team, and battered Dundalk, and Dundalk couldn't hang on. You know, now maybe a crowd willing him on might have helped him a little bit, but we're kind of arguing, kind of, you know, we don't know. It's fantasy, you know. Maybe it would have helped, maybe it wouldn't have helped. And I agree with Dan as well. Sometimes if a game isn't going your way, a crowd could be a hindrance. So, look, you can talk about it. It's hypothetical. That's the word I was looking for. You don't know. Ultimately, the parameters were known before the game. They're going to be known before the next lot. You know, you now get to go to the Emirates, where Arsenal won't have a crowd. So does that help you, the fact that there's not going to be a crowd at the Emirates? When you go to Mulder, does it help you, that the fact that they won't have a crowd? it's irrelevant, man. And there are points that we just have to accept. The world is the way it is. You know, the fixture list is the way it is, and we just got to get on with it.
We'll turn to Arsenal in just 1 second. I just want to bring in Andy Dunn live from the Aviva Stadium, because Johnny Sexton's standing over a penalty here, Johnny, or Andy, I should say. It was a messy start for Ireland, but they're starting to get control now.
Yeah, there's 14 minutes gone. It's now 10 points to 3. The Italians took a 3-0 lead after a very creative early line break by Pelledri, who fed Violi, the Italian scrum half, was hauled down about a yard short of the line by his opposite number, Conor Murray, who paid the price, I suppose, for saving our blushes. He actually lay on top of the ball and was yellow carded for a cynical challenge. So the Italians took a 3-0 lead. Since that, Ireland have been a bit more commanding and composed. CJ Stander scoring one of, I suppose, his typical style tries, picking up very close to the Italian line, try line, a half a yard away from the try line, and at that close to the ground, he can outmuscle anyone. So one try, one penalty for Ireland, 10 points to 3 after 14 minutes.
Yeah, so Ireland's starting to look a bit more comfortable. We'll be back to Andy throughout this game between now and 5 o'clock. Just to let you know as well, Kerry sealed their Division 1 title in the Allianz Football League 2018 to 10-point winners against Donegal at Austin Stack Park in Tralee. Meanwhile, Roscommon, it seems, have been promoted from Division 2, won 12 to 13-point winners against Cavan. Armagh saw off Clare, 118 to 113. Kildare, 16 points to 11 winners against Westmeath, while it finished Laois 3-12, Fermanagh 1-11. Fermanagh were winning for much of that game, but it seems a late comeback has seen Laois get the win. And then in Division 4, Limerick 116 to 114 winners against Sligo. Antrim 214 to 13 winners against Waterford. And at Chadwick's Wexford Park, it finished Wicklow 13 points, Wexford 10. The Leinster Senior Hurling Championship quarterfinal between Dublin and Laois throws in at 6. Guys, we mentioned Arsenal there just before we got our updates from around the grounds. Small little task now for Dundalk this coming week. I'm sure it's going to be an absolutely fantastic experience for all of them.
Yeah, I mean, like, it is sort of a... I think Damo actually spoke before about the Emirates and the bus journey and the crowds and stuff, and they're obviously going to miss all of that. And it's actually interesting, it's worth noting, the week after they play Rapid Vienna away, and there actually will be a crowd at that game. I'm not sure what the story is in Norway, but definitely in Vienna, there was a crowd at the Rapid Vienna Arsenal game the other night. So the Irish League is going to get a sense of an atmosphere at some stage in the group, but not in this game. Alligator, I mean, it's very hard to know like what type of team Arsenal have put out. I think they play Manchester United 3 days later, isn't it?
On the Sunday.
You know, again, I'm sure they will look at Dundalk as a team that they would expect to beat quite comfortably. So I'm not sure. Like, you have to register a squad for the Europa League, don't you? So you have to register a 23, 25 man squad. I know you can mix it up a bit if you have X amount of homegrown players and stuff, but That in itself means that whatever team they're going to put out is still going to be a strong enough side. They can't play Ozil, obviously, because he didn't make the squad. But like they have, like, you know, they're going to have quality players there. And it is a strange one. I wonder, like, where the no crowd thing as well, if you have that sort of training game aspect to it, does it lead to it being a bit more sedate at times? It's going to be a great buzz for the players. Of course it is. And I don't know. I haven't played in a full Emirates, so Damo can tell us the difference. You know, how it will compare. It's not like, it's still a pitch. It's players. Like, they're playing in the Aviva now. Like, they're used to playing in decent arenas. Yeah. It's there's the star-studded aspect of the team you're playing against. But I suppose they're not going to be overawed by, like, their preparations aren't going to be dominated by, I have to get tickets for my brother or my cousin or my mates, or, you know, all the stuff about sort of, all that sort of fanfare that goes with it. Like, the Spurs Shamrock Rovers game in 2011 was probably one of the most enjoyable occasions I've probably been at, because there was that whole sense of, like, there was a massive...
The White Hart Lane game?
The White Hart Lane game, the away game. The White Hart Lane one. Now, they actually went ahead.
Yeah.
And they then Spurs, all of a sudden, the press box in White Hart Lane is right behind the bench. So, like, there's actually a photo of a couple of us there with Gareth Bale just sat in front of us. And all of a sudden, when Shamrock Rovers went ahead, I think Bale and Pavlyuchenko were sent out to warm up. But there was a whole sense of, there was loads of Rovers fans, but also I think a lot of Irish in London and stuff as well. And it was a real sort of festival atmosphere around it. Whereas this is more like they'll have their bus in and their bus out, but there'll be none of that noise. They know people are watching. I'm sure they're aware that this game will be watched. Like, you know, the services that are available in Ireland or around the world, it'll be watching loads and loads of countries. But I guess when they're in their arena, it's just going to be the shouts and sounds of themselves. I mean, these closed doors games are so weird in their own way. Like they really are. It's guys shouting the instructions that they shout to each other all the time, every day. That's the world that they know. And you're playing against a better class of team, but you're still going to try and probably do your normal routine as much as you can, and maybe the lack of occasion makes it easier to do that. I mean, it's a hard one. It's a bloody hard one, but you're kind of hoping in reality that Arsenal have a bit of a complacent approach to it and allow Dundalk to settle into the game at least a bit and see where it takes them.
Damien, is it one of those days where it's probably just more so about those lads going out and actually just embracing the experience of it all?
Yeah, we don't want to be a tourist either, you know. I'm pretty sure they can go the day after the game and get the Emirates tour and take all the photographs they want, you know. And that's something we used to speak about, you know, sometimes when you go to these big stadiums, the first year you go in the Premier League, you can end up being it. And I remember we had a meeting one day and we spoke about, listen, you know, we're not showing up here as tourists. We're not taking photographs. We're not Snapchatting videos before the game of the changing room and losing focus. You know, the game is the game. If you want to do all that, come back the next day and go on the tour with the rest of the tourists, you know. So, you know, it's going to be a great experience for them. They're going to fly over, stay in a central London hotel. As I said last week, it would have been nice for them to pull onto the Holloway Road and drive up there and see all the hot dog stands and, you know, merchandise for sale, the fans, the police escort. Then you round the corner and you see all the statues of, you know, Thierry Henry and you see the, you know, the kind of the traditional players all arm in arm across the stadium, you know, from Brady to Adams to Bergkamp to Parler, you know, that thing they have wrapping the stadium. And it's nice. Then you disappear under the stadium and it's fantastic. And I know you're saying there that the pitches are the same and that, but it's not. The Emirates is by far and away the best pitch in the Premier League. It's so lush. It's so quick. You know, they will know as soon as you step on that pitch, you'll know something's different. It's not like the Aviva where the grass is bare and it's a standard Deso pitch. I don't know what they do with it, but it is by far and away the best pitch in the Premier League. It's one of the biggest pitches as well. The stadium is one of the most palatial stadiums. I remember you used to always look forward to the food afterwards in the changing room of the Emirates. You know, it was fantastic. You used to get salmon on bagels and sushi and the whole lot. So
it's, no takeaway pizza there. You don't get your takeaway pizza absolutely, and take it with you.
No wedges and stuff like that that you get in most places. They do look after them. And the changing rooms are huge. You know, there's four or five rooms within the changing room for staff, for physios, for massage, for warm-up area, the whole nine yards, you know. So it's a fantastic experience. But my advice to the players is just stay focused on the task at hand. You know, the memories will live with you. Don't get caught up in it before the game. As soon as you kind of leave Dublin or to go to the UK, that's it. Just get your game face on, get into game mode and stay in it. You know, the memories and the things that last with you, the special things that happen, then you can worry about it. 10 o'clock on Thursday night, you can go back out on the pitch and take all the photographs you want. You know, stay focused. You're a footballer, that's your job. Concentrate on getting a result or putting in the best performance you possibly can. And all the hype that goes with it. Worry about that on Friday morning.
All right, on that note, we're going to have to take a quick break. Half-time is there from Fulham against Crystal Palace. Palace leading 1-0 from the Jarrod Riedewald goal. Manchester United and Chelsea kicks off at 5:30, with Liverpool and Sheffield United coming up at 8. And also in the rugby, 20 minutes played at the Aviva Stadium. It's still Ireland 10, Italy 3. Back after the break.
Paddy Power. As much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
So we are streaming at the moment across all of our social platforms and on the OTB Sports app. And all of this with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit dunlewy.net. Guys, we'll turn our attention now back towards the Premier League. Probably the biggest story in terms of what happened on the pitch was Virgil van Dijk's injury in the Merseyside derby last week. Dan, you were obviously here when we were kind of debating this out straight afterwards on the show, when we didn't really know the extent of the injury van Dijk got. It's obviously emerged. It's an ACL injury. He's had surgery and he's going to be out for what we expect is pretty much the entire season.
Yeah, no, like having done an ACL myself before, I remember thinking, you know, someone walking off the pitch isn't necessarily always a good thing. Yeah. You know, it's unfortunately, it's one of those ones that it's a It's a you know, it can deceive people into thinking someone walking on or even playing on for a couple of minutes doesn't disguise the reality of it. And it's a nasty one. It's a real, I don't know, like, I mean, we're probably going to have a debate around Pickford now and the challenge. I mean, like, I certainly don't think if someone's going to do someone, like, you know, to really, like, maliciously do someone in your own penalty area defending across is, like, the time that you're going to do it. It was just really, you know, clumsy and like, for me, a red card offence, definitely. I take all of those points on board, but I don't know if it's in his head at that stage to, like, really do someone. Like, a lot of those, unfortunately, those type of injuries, you know, it's just how you land, where your foot is planted. It can be bad luck as much as it's you know, bad intentions. And it's, I mean, it's a shocker for him. I mean, it's really, really unfortunate. I mean, both club-wise and international-wise, like, he's going to miss a lot of big games. And it is, I mean, it does definitely have game-changing potential in the title race. I'm sure we've spoken in this forum in the past before about, you know, even when Liverpool won the league, okay, they blitzed it in the end. But in the early stage, you probably talk about, you know, well, what could go wrong? Like, what are the things that could go wrong? Let's list things that could happen. And I think, you know, an injury for Van Dijk would be right up at the top of the list. And given the issues they'd had, you know, with say Gomez's form and suddenly trying to figure out, like, what is their best partnership? It's always been a scenario of who's his best partner. And to be without him now completely, it's rough, you know. It is a rough one. I don't know what the lad's take is generally on the tackle itself. There's still, I saw Jamie Carragher's column and spoke about it quite well. Again, wrote about it, you know, how he injured, I think it was Nani he injured at one point,
yeah.
And how he was actually haunted a bit by being responsible for someone's injury. He wasn't just sort of laughing it off, and he seemed to be suggesting that Pickford would be actually feeling pretty low over his involvement in the whole thing.
Yeah, certainly. Damien, I might bring you in here now. Like, we'll kind of get to the impact this has for Liverpool in a little bit, but first of all, like, what has your reaction been to, I suppose, the fallout over the last week and the way it's kind of all just bled out all over the media?
Yeah, look, you're always going to have that when a player of his stature and as high profile as Van Dijk is out for the season. And with the only Liverpool supporters in the world, they're obviously thinking that their chances of, you know, winning in Europe this year or regaining the Premier League title have taken a massive hit. So there's obviously going to be the initial fury and rage and blame. My take on it, Dawn Pickford isn't a malicious person. Now, I know everyone says, oh, you don't have to be malicious to do a malicious thing. You know, I think he's genuinely tried to make himself as big as possible and smother the ball. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the ball comes in, he wasn't insanely late. Like, you know, it was a little bit late. I mean, he's obviously realised he's got to close the angle to give himself a better opportunity of stopping the shot. And I think once he goes airborne, and that's his mistake, he launches. And once he's airborne, he's lost complete control. And Van Dijk's obviously planted his leg and has got nowhere to go, but his ACL's got to give way. I don't think in Jordan Pickford's mind in any way before he was kind of travelling towards Van Dijk, did he think, I'm going to do him here? You know, I think he's genuinely been too aggressive. And it should have been a red card. But I don't believe for a second that he kind of, I won't say like premeditated, but, you know, the split second before, and he thought, I'm just going to do him here. I don't think there's very many players in the world think like that. Sometimes you think, I'm going to go in hard or I'm going to leave a bit on him to let him know I'm in the game. And sometimes you can get them ones wrong and injure someone seriously. And you know, it's not an intentional premeditated attack. It wasn't a great attempt. I still think he could have closed the angle and made himself big and kept at least one foot on the ground and closed down the distance to give himself a better chance. But look, it is what it is. He's injured now, he's out, and that's kind of my take on it, really.
Mm-hmm. From like what Pickford would be thinking now, like, were you ever in a situation in your career where you made a tackle in good faith and, you know, it just happened to be mistimed and it caused a bad injury for a player?
Yeah, I won't say lots, but yeah, a few times, you know. I remember one time in training I caught a player and I felt his ankle give way underneath me, you know, I'd kind of followed through in a tackle, and his foot was caught underneath me, and obviously the only thing that could give way was his ankle ligaments, and I actually felt them go. Yeah, it was a strong tackle, but like I didn't go in there and think that I'm going to injure him or yeah. I want to do that. It's very, 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 very rare that happens. Look, he'll be disappointed, Pickford, and I'm pretty sure once the whole thing settles down, he will reach out to Van Dijk and say, look, it was reckless, definitely, but there's no way I wanted to seriously injure you or think that I was going to put you out for a year or I wanted to break your leg or anything like that. But at the moment, it's just a huge furore about it. And once that settles down, Liverpool will just get on with the season and Van Dijk will get on with his rehab.
Mm-hmm. David, I've kind of kept you silent there for a few minutes since we came back from the break. Like, I think obviously the big thing, the outcome obviously dictates the way the conversation goes. Like, you know, Virgil van Dijk does his ACL, he's out for the season. I would probably argue that the tackle Richarlison got sent off for on, I think it was Thiago towards the end of the game. Like, if you're looking at the two challenges, that one certainly looked miles worse and miles more dangerous. It's just the way the players connected together. It's the Van Dijk one that, you know, caused the problem.
Sometimes it can be just a lottery. It's how the other person's body is as well. Like, the fallout to it, like, you're judging online and stuff, the fallout to it has been ridiculous. It really has. And like, what I would say is from Jordan Pickford's point of view, like what Damien said, I don't think it's malicious, but what I think as a goalkeeper, sometimes they kind of realise they can maybe get away with a bit more in terms of what they do, even with their feet and their body, than outfield players. Like, even when I was growing up, even being taught as a goalkeeper in the park, you're always taught when you're coming out to jump, you almost jump with your knee out a little bit, you know, to protect yourself. I think goalkeepers tend to get a lot more protection than any other player on the pitch, but then also would almost get away with a bit more in terms of how they would be. Like, even you see some players coming out, I think it was Wijnaldum and even Adrian coming out and having a go at Pickford for it, which I think was a little bit unnecessary, because like, It's not as if it's two lads going in a battle in the middle of the centre, in the middle of the pitch, and you've been at each other all game, and you sense there's a bit of needle. It did just strike. Yeah, it was a very, very clumsy tackle, but it didn't strike me as something that was, as Damon was saying, premeditated, or there was like that needle in the game, and then you get the fallout, and some of the reaction to it has just been kind of needless. It's over the top. And like, the main thing now is Liverpool just have to regroup. They have to kind of find a way to look settled again at the back without Van Dijk. I'm not sure when Alisson's going to be back as well, because that's obviously a big loss too, because you kind of get the sense even before Van Dijk got injured with what Aston Villa did to them, and then in that game kind of they looked so infallible kind of last year. They were like by far and away the best team. They still would be favourites to win the league, but when you lose a player like Van Dijk, and you've seen it with even to a different totally different extent, but the likes of say United, when they lose that kind of aura about them, teams now might have that little bit more belief going into games at Liverpool, and it's about how they react. They had a good reaction with the win against Ajax in midweek, but it's going to be a big test, I would say, now for the lads, because I don't know, like, again, like, Damien's a professional here, he'll know how players think, but you kind of wonder, no matter what level they're at, like, how players react. Like, not that they feel like safer because a player of Van Dijk is around them, but like, when you lose that, it's like it has to have a bit of an impact on them in terms of, ooh, what's going to happen here now, because before he arrived, that was Liverpool's big weak point. That's what everyone said. He's the one who changed the game for them, despite that attacking threat that they have with Mane, who I still think is just a fantastic player. I think he's the best player in the league, just his all-round attitude and what he brings, and that forward three. But like, people were talking of Van Dijk, he just brought that solidity to Liverpool, that's what they were missing, the fact that, like, he could be the one who, when they needed to just grind out a win 1-0 or whatever, he was the fella who kind of brought that with them. And that's what's going to be very important now for Liverpool and for Klopp over the next while, is getting that sense of, yeah, like, they're the champions, but having that sense of, yeah, no one's going to just turn us over, no one, just because we've lost Van Dijk, it's not going to make us any weaker. That's what they have to show now.
Yeah, so Damien, like, the impact on Liverpool and how big a loss this is going to be, like, losing a talisman. How did, like, for example, how did Crystal Palace ever cope when you were missing games?
I don't know. I just think footballers are very resilient mentally, and they accept situations very, very quickly. A manager will change the narrative quickly. The Virgil gone, and when you are injured, what I will say is you often feel like the forgotten man. You know, you're kind of on your own time schedule. You're not parvy, you're not in meetings. You know, you have a quick word with the manager, but you feel out of the loop. And I think that's the way it has to be, because the manager needs to change the narrative and say, he's injured now, no problem. We've got to get on with our season. And Liverpool's focus will be on retaining the league. What I will say is that, you know, Man City have lost company. And you saw the effect that had on them, that's having on them. And I think Van Dijk going is even that up now. I think it's just a case of which one of them can be the slightly better of the worst back fours. you know, if Laporte gets back, that might tip it in Man City's favour, to be honest, because both of them aren't blessed at all with options. They're two teams that are going to compete for the Premier League, absolutely. It just means that Liverpool are going to finish up, I would say, somewhere between 80 and 90 points, and Man City will finish up the same. I think without Van Dijk and without company, the 100 points is kind of, you know, not attainable for either of those teams. So it's whichever one could cope with the worst back fours, and whoever can either, you know, outscore the other one is going to win the Premier League. Or you might see a dark horse come, Leicester or something like that, because if the total amount of points required is going to be in the 80s, which I think it will be, then I think it could bring teams like potentially a Leicester or that type of scenario that we had in 2016 again. So, look, it's just levelled it up a little bit, and it'll probably make for a more interesting title race. Liverpool weren't flying with Van Dijk in the team anyway. I think a bigger concern now is getting the goalkeeper back, because he can definitely save you some points. But as a club, they'll just accept the situation and move on with it.
So would you say then, Damien, that, like, we'll say that the impact, it's not so much the impact it's going to have on Liverpool and the players and the way they're thinking. It might actually just be on the likes of Man City or some of the other potential title contenders, that they will look at Liverpool if they're playing them and they're not necessarily as intimidated. There isn't as, you know, as a totemic pole sitting there in the centre of defence.
Yeah, listen, I mean, obviously, when you're, if you see the team sheet comes in and Van Dijk isn't on it, you automatically think we got a better chance today. So I think Manchester City would be buoyed a little bit by the fact that he's out. They'll think that, you know, Liverpool are a little bit closer to us now, and it will make it potentially easier for us to catch them and win the league. But footballers just accept it. I remember there was a time we were at Crystal Palace the year we... I don't know what year it was. It was one of the years anyway. We were in a relegation battle, and the African Cup of Nations was on, and the what's that one that Australia compete in there? The Asia Cup or something, is it? The Asia Cup.
Asia Cup.
And we lost. Yeah, we lost our captain Mile Jedinak, and we lost Wilfred Zaha to both those tournaments, and we were kind of a point outside the relegation zone, and both of them left after the game on St. Stephen's Day. And we were without them potentially the first couple of weeks of February. But, you know, Alan Pardew was the manager at the time, and he just shifted the focus and said, OK, they're gone, no problem. We just got to, you know, it's an opportunity for somebody else to step up, and we got to get on. And to be honest, we picked up more points in that six-week period than we did with them. Now, obviously, when they came back, they both went straight back in the team, because they were very, very good players and very, very important to us. But it's important for a manager not to, you know, he might be crying in his office or crying himself to sleep at night time when he gets home. But when he's in the building and when he's out in the training ground, he has to act like he's in complete control and that he had a plan for this and it's not an issue and we're going to move on with it. And then that's what he will do. And as soon as Liverpool play tonight, Virgil van Dijk will be forgotten about, and Klopp will be planning without him now until probably the start of next season.
So, I suppose this one for all three of you guys. What are we thinking is the long-term plan for this season for the centre defence partnership? Are we going to see Fabinho coming in there a lot more? Like, we would have seen it previously, just every now and again for a game. Is he actually a potential option there for the season?
There seems to be a strong feeling that it might go that way. Like, I mean, we'll bow to sort of Damo's knowledge of the position there in terms of like what it actually takes and how transferable are some of those skills for like that sort of that holding midfielder to like. It depends. I mean, I suppose they're going to be still quite dominant in a lot of games. And say, I suppose the questions asked of a central defender there might be slightly different to what's asked of a central defender, say, if you're in a relegation battle, you know, and you're in a team that sets up to be without the ball a lot of the time or whatever it might be. I mean, I know, like, I mean, Gomez was sort of in vogue towards the end of last season. There was a sense, yeah, all of a sudden it's really clicked for him. He's really found his groove, but his form is a concern. But I don't know. It does seem like they're gearing that way. I don't know. Like, the other lads come in if they have a strong view on it.
I think that similar to Manchester City. Sorry, David, let you come in there. Manchester City put Fernandinho back there, and you can go back there and you can fill in for a couple of games and opposite. You're fine 90% of the time, but consistency and in the moments that really matter. And on top of that, if Fabinho goes back there and he has a weak point, if he has poor positioning or he takes up certain positions quite regularly, opposition teams will figure that out and they will sense those or see those weaknesses in him. And they'll exploit them, you know. So he won't go back there and be a natural centre-back. He will have some flaws like Fernandinho did. And Fernandinho was quite comfortably go back filling in for Manchester City. But you saw over the course of the season, asking him to play there was too much, you know, to play 30, 40 games. And on top of that, Fabinho's a central midfield player and they need him in the central midfield. And if they lose him out of central midfield, it's kind of a double whammy for him there. So he could definitely fill in for a game. Gomez and Matip are kind of your two guys. But as I said, they're going to fall off that 100-point kind of tally that they had last year, without doubt.
Mm-hmm. Right, I just need to jump in here, guys. Halftime whistle is gone at the Aviva Stadium, so we're going to cross over now to Andy Dunn, who's been watching it. Andy, Ireland well in control now, and what a debut for Hugo Keenan.
Absolutely, yeah, 24-3 at halftime, and Keenan robbed of a debut hat-trick in the first half. He's scored two tries. In between those two tries, he had a try disallowed. The English referee and his team somehow conspired against him. It was a brilliant try, probably the try of the game, where a deep raking kick from the Italians landed in Stockdale's hand outside his own 22, and Stockdale made a brilliant counter attack. Sliced through the Italian defence, beat a couple of defenders and made a long pass to Keenan, who finished brilliantly in the corner. They couldn't trace him down, the Italian cover. But while Sexton was preparing for the place kick, they went back to the video referee, and James Ryan inexplicably was deemed to have gotten in the way of one of the Italian defenders. He barely made contact, and on video it looked like he barely made contact. Somehow they decided he'd caused an obstruction. It was an extremely harsh decision, and denied Keenan his second try. He did go on about 7 minutes later. Ireland, Caelan Doris robbed a ball deep in the Irish territory at a ruck, managed to break out in our own 22, passed to Aki, who passed to Murray, and Murray showed real class in midfield and composure, had multiple options on, decided the best one was to with agile feet was to put in a long raking rubber kick into the 22 and trust Keenan's pace, and Keenan outpaced the Italian cover again for a third time and a second legal try. So Ireland well in control. The Italians do look like they've got some promise, particularly in their new young halfbacks in Violi and Garbisi, potentially something they can build a stronger team around in the future. But in terms of their overall play, it's the same old Italy, some promising attack, but a lack of attention to detail and crucial mistakes at crucial times are costing them.
I've been kind of had half an eye on it here in the studio with me while I'm chatting with the lads. Certainly looks like one person who's having a great game outside of Hugo Keenan is Andrew Porter. I've seen a couple of big scrums, a couple of huge turnovers from him.
Yeah, well, I would have to say the initial definitely a couple of scrums. The initial scrum where he won a penalty seemed probably rightfully could have been disputed by the Italians. He did seem to drop before the Italian scrum, got his chest slightly lower than his hips and fell, and maybe was on a more fortunate side on that decision. Nonetheless, his work rate and his subsequent scrums have been very, very stable, and it's also an area where the Italians are traditionally very, very strong. So Porter is absolutely measuring up and making a contribution all around the field. Other standout players in the half, probably you'd have to say Jacob Stockdale. Again, it's mitigating circumstances for Stockdale and Keenan. They're running in open country against a broken, disorganised defence. Nonetheless, it's been exciting to watch.
Yeah, and on Stockdale as well there, actually, like you were talking about Hugo Keenan's disallowed try in between the two that were given. It was a bit of brilliance from Jacob Stockdale that would have set it all up.
Yeah, it was a deep kick into Irish territory. Garbisi has a huge raking left boot and is very comfortable to sit back in the pocket and launch a few. Stockdale's positioning was excellent. Caught it just before it went into touch. One of those ones where he tiptoed close to the touchline, leaned out and caught it. He then brought it back in field. There was a slightly disorganized Italian line in front of him, and he found a couple of spaces that he needed to and ran through. That was where the crucial disallowed decision came from, and I think extremely harsh in retrospect when you look back and see James Ryan barely making contact with one of the Italians. He certainly didn't cause an obstruction for the Italian player to make a tackle. He did make very, very light contact, but it was unintentional. So yeah, Stockdale's brilliance there is diminished by poor refereeing.
And final question then, the other debutant today, Will Connors, how's he doing?
Yeah, it's hard to ascertain the impact he's having because the game is so broken up. It's quite disjointed. He hasn't had much opportunity to carry the ball. He's certainly been aggressive at the breakdown, as is his job. But in terms of obvious contribution, it's been muted.
Very good. Andy Dunn will be back with you between now and 5 o'clock for a few more updates in the second half. We have another goal at Craven Cottage, Fulham and Crystal Palace with the details, Mike Lawrence.
Fulham 0, Crystal Palace 2. Palace doubling their lead again against the run of the play. Wilfried Zaha running in at close range. Batshuayi's cross from the right. Zaha slotted home. It looks like he collided with the post. He's having treatment. He got injured for his efforts. But Palace doubling their lead. Fulham 0, Crystal Palace 2.
And then we also have just to bring you up to date on the scores in the Championship. They're heading into the final, just over 20 minutes to go. So Swansea are 1-0 up away to Bristol City. Earlier, Watford played out a 1-1 draw with Bournemouth. Middlesbrough leading Cardiff City away from home 1-0. It is 3-0 to Blackburn Rovers against Coventry. Preston 2-1 up on Huddersfield. Alan Brown has scored a couple of goals in that game for Preston. Millwall and Barnsley are level at 1-1. Same with Norwich and Wickham. It's scoreless between QPR and Birmingham. Reading 1-0 up on Rotherham United. Sheffield Wednesday and Luton still scoreless. And Stoke City 3-0 up on Brentford with James McLean among the scorers in that game as well. Time for a quick break. We will be back with more from Dan McDonald, Damien Delaney and David Snaid afterwards.
Paddy Power. As much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
You're very welcome back to Off the Ball this Saturday. Neil Tracy with you for another half an hour here on News Talk on OTB Football Saturday. Now, just to bring you up to date, there are a couple of crucial games going on in the SSC or Tricity League First Division. Just over 75 minutes played in both of these games. It's currently Bray Wanderers 0, Galway United 0 and Drogheda 1-0 up against Wexford FC. So as things stand at the moment, heading into the final round of matches in a few days' time, is that Drogheda United, as things stand, if they hold on and win, they will go top ahead of Bray Wanderers on goal difference. But if Bray managed to get a winner between now and the 90th minute, they're scoreless against Galway, they would go back ahead of Drogheda United and have their fate in their own hands heading into the final round of games. Drogheda will be taking on Cabinteely away from home, while Bray Wanderers will be away to Athlone Town. Now, a few more texts to get through here. While the results didn't go our way and I felt Ireland did more than enough to win the game last night, so many chances that sadly didn't go our way on another night they probably would have and Ireland could win the game comfortably. The future of the women's game is looking bright with so many talented players. That is from Kira in Thurles. We also have another one saying on the Jordan Pickford and Virgil van Dijk situation, there's no question that Pickford was reckless, but no way malicious. All top teams must cope with these injuries. Why so much coverage? That one is from John. And then one more text I might put to you, Damien. Do you think this might be another odd Premier League season with an outsider team like Leicester winning the league like they did a few years back? It's probably not going to happen. But then again, who knows what's happening anymore with the way this year has gone? That's from Aaron in Galway. And just to go on to Aaron's point, I was going into, for the first 20-25 minutes of last night's game between Aston Villa and Leeds, for example, I was thinking to myself, Aston Villa are doing a Leicester this year. They are absolutely doing a Leicester.
I was last Sunday after a half time thinking my man Jose was going to be
yeah, easier. Exactly.
I was thinking this is it. It's going to happen. But unfortunately, they fell apart. It could be there's every chance, you know, that maybe someone like, I don't know, Leeds or something might make, I'm not saying win the league, obviously, but I'm saying they might make the Champions League, or they might get in the Europa League like Wolves did. You never know, but I still fancy Liverpool and Man City to be the last two teams standing come the end of the season.
We might talk about Man United here, guys, because they're in action against Chelsea at 5:30. Team news is coming in the next couple of minutes. But a bizarre few weeks, I think, for United. We were talking about them last week, about how badly they needed a win, Dan. And then all of a sudden, they got the win against Newcastle, fell behind early. But ultimately, it was, you know, it was a late winner, but they were well worth the win, considering how bad Newcastle were. And then they head off to Paris and pull one out of the bag on Tuesday night.
Oh, it's a great result. Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific result for them. I don't know, like, I just feel like every sort of couple of months we talk about like a great week for Manchester United and think, well, this is it, you know, they've turned some kind of corner now, or things are going their way, and this is the start of something. And it never seems to be the case, really, in terms of a sustained turnaround. So I'm sort of loath to get carried away on the basis, as you mentioned, of like beating
Dan. Get carried away. They're back. No.
I mean, we had Johnny Ward here talking about them being title challengers this season. This is back in the summer after they'd beat a number of teams in the bottom half of the table. And, you know, this is it. Like, they might challenge next year. It's like, you know, so I'm not so sure about that, to be honest. Like, I still don't think ultimately, I just feel like they're always two or three games away from a crisis under Ole. So I don't know if he's ever going to be a sort of a title challenging manager once he's there. They've got good players. They've got, like, you know, some really excellent players. So they will get good results. But I don't think that I didn't think they were going to make the top four this year. Now, it's a bit of a mad year, but I'm not tempted to change that prediction, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. I'll bring you in, Damien, here in just a second as well. But the team news is in for that game between Man United and Chelsea at Old Trafford. We can get the details now with Darren Stanage.
Three changes for Manchester United from the win at PSG. Maguire is back, and Juan Mata and Dan James return. So that's the same team which beat Newcastle 4-1. No Alex Teller's in the squad. Greenwood returns, and it's a place on the bench for new boy Edison Cavani alongside Pogba and Van de Beek. Chelsea bring in Cesar Azpilicueta into their side. Mason Mount drops out. That's going to mean a formation change for them. A back three. United looking for their first win of the season here at Old Trafford. Chelsea a first win at 7 here at the Theatre of Dreams. It's United against Chelsea.
Damien, are you surprised that Axel Tanzebe isn't getting another run? Very impressive on Tuesday evening.
Yeah, he was fabulous, you know, and Dan's quite correct there. Man United have some very good players. They've still spent probably close to nearly, £750 million since Ferguson left, if not even more. You know, Solskjaer still spent £220 million in his own right, so they will get results, of course. Well, they've got some very good players, but I think back to that Michael Jordan quote. It was actually in the gym in Crystal Palace. It was, players win games, teams win championships. And I just don't think Manchester United are a team. They've got individual players that can almost certainly turn up on Champions League nights at the Parc des Princes and feel and hear that music and get results. But to win a league, you've got to be absolutely relentless, you know. And if you want to compare team for team between Liverpool and Man United, Liverpool are streets ahead of Manchester United at the moment, just consistency wise, you know. I just can't see Manchester United getting 80, 90, 100 points, to be honest. They're too inconsistent, and a lot of it comes from the manager.
David, is like part of the problem, well, I suppose a big part of the problem at United, that they seem over the last year to have been well able to do it on the big occasion, but it's the run-of-the-mill games throughout the season, like they would have had when they dropped points in the first couple of matches. That's where ultimately, if you look down the last couple of years, where they're really, really missing out.
Yeah, and like Damon hit the nail on the head. You have to be relentless. Like, one of the quotes from Solskjaer before the PSG game during the week was kind of like, these are the games as a Man United player that you have to thrive on, that you have to look forward to. And yeah, obviously they're the games where people would expect, but no, the attitude should be every single game. Like, if the players in that United team, say when it's Crystal Palace at home, or if it's Spurs at home, like obviously today Chelsea, they're the games where they should be going out to actually want to just stamp their authority on the game and just like grind teams down, whether they win 3 or 4 nil, doesn't really matter. It's like just dominating games. So like if you look at it from the point of view of Solskjaer and even kind of ties in with Lampard, like both managers last year pretty much delivered the minimum that was would have been required of them in terms of Champions League qualification. Yeah, when you look at it in terms of the two teams who finished above them, that was probably the maximum they could have delivered last season, but both of them were miles off the two teams ahead of them. That's what's going to be, that's what will define both managers, but obviously especially Solskjaer, because he's a bit further ahead of Lampard in terms of how long he's been in the job, would be at the end of this season, if he can actually prove well then that he's able to turn a team from being inconsistent into a team that challenges, well, that's what at the end of this year will keep him in the job. I don't think necessarily he has to win the league this year, but he has to prove that United aren't that inconsistent force. And to be honest, I don't think it's going to happen, because when you look at, there's two quotes from players this season that kind of stand out, and I think kind of maybe just tell the tale of just where the squad and the team is at. Was after the first game of this season, you had Luke Shaw coming out talking about how we needed to sign players, we haven't got enough players, we need help. And then you look at Bruno Fernandes talking about signings, and he's saying it doesn't matter, people can talk about a signing coming in, a new striker, a midfielder, a goalkeeper, whoever. It's not up to that. It's about the players who are on the pitch to try and do it. And I think that kind of just sums up the differences, even of players who are in that United team and the mentality that I just don't think it's there at the moment. And whether or not if Solskjaer can deliver that, and I don't think today will be an indication of, yeah, everything's going to be rosy if United go and win today, because it was, again, they beat Chelsea a couple of times last year. But like when you look at it, when it got to the business end of things last year, you know, you got over the line in the Champions League, but when it was in the Europa League and the FA Cup and those cup competitions, they just fell short again. And yeah, they can be very, very polarised, and it's almost as if, like, I put up a tweet jokingly, a bit very sarcastic through the week, saying, oh, Solskjaer the fraud, because it seems as if people are in one camp or the other. And I think at the moment he's still in the middle a little bit. We'll know at the end of this season, I think, because I don't think, and Damon's already said it, that I don't think it's going to be a case that Liverpool and City are going to be hitting that 100-point mark or even the 90-point mark again. But then when you look at where United were with Chelsea last year, they were about on 66 points. Like they need to be getting a lot more than that. So if they're able to, if United at the end of this season have somehow managed to put up a challenge, I think that would buy Solskjaer a little bit more time, because he has shown sporadically that he does know how to set up teams. It's just getting that message through to the players that every single game is so important, because sometimes you just think they're phoning it in.
Damien, McTominay and Fred in midfield again today. What does Donny van de Beek have to do to actually get a start?
See, that's a functional midfield, and that's why they lose games, because you can't just go to, when you play PSG and set up defensively and Nick Gold's on the counter, you're not going to win leagues playing counter-attacking football. To win a league, you have to go and win games of football where things aren't going your way, and that's where you have to have a relentless mentality and a mindset for the players. I mean, you compare Luke Shaw and Andy Robertson, that's chalk and cheese. You know, Andy Robertson will give you, I'd say, over 38 Premier League game season, he'll give you 34, 35, 8, 9 out of 10 games, you know, and he'll have one or two bad ones and one or two 6 out of 10s. Luke Shaw will give you 15 good games, 8, 9 out of 10, and then the rest, that's why they don't win games of football. They have too many players that are like that. They're just not relentless enough. And look, United are short, man, and I think the manager drives that, you know, has to have that level of kind of motivation their players to show up and say, right, you know, I don't have to motivate you for the PSG game, because that's self-motivating in itself. But Crystal Palace at home, Tottenham at home, Chelsea at home today, they're the games where the players are tired. There's a huge emotional high after Tuesday night, and after that high comes a low. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, players are kind of coming down off that emotional high, and they're all feeling good about themselves. It's up to management to rally all those players, get them back up, motivate them. And some managers motivate by fear, you know, some are like Klopp with their enthusiasm and stuff, but he needs to keep driving Manchester United. And I just think that they're not going to give you 34, 35, 9 or 10 games a season. They haven't got enough players that'll do that.
Dan, it would be, I suppose, remiss of us not to mention Marcus Rashford, but not so much for scoring a winner against PSG on Tuesday night, but for what he's been doing off the pitch and the headlines he's been making over the last week, and just showing the, I suppose, the power and the influence that, like, a top Premier League footballer can have in the world.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, like we're just going to repeat ourselves, like we're sort of repeat platitudes by talking about it. But I mean, it is, it is true. Like, you know, that the sometimes, and like it's not for everyone. And I appreciate why, you know, sometimes like sports people will go their own way, and they don't almost want to go down that road for fear of almost it almost opens them up to exposure of like. There was always this feeling with Rashford now when he started doing, oh, people are going to start digging off stuff about him now or whatever.
And waiting for him to make a mistake.
Waiting for him to fall, yeah. Like you put yourself on a pedestal and then all of a sudden you can, you know, the fall can be mighty. But really, like, I don't see how anyone could take issue with his campaign. It is relentless, but it does appear like he's been very actively, like it's not sort of a PR job run by his handlers, that he is a... Like he's obviously been touched by his own life experience and has decided to use his influence for good. And I mean, as I've never lived in the UK, the two lads have, you know. So like, it's obviously there's obviously complications with society there at the moment. It's been a sort of a turbulent couple of years, and even see now across the last week the sort of situation in Manchester, and that mm-hmm. sort of difference almost between the north and the south, even in England. And Rashford has become a very, you know, a spokesperson for like a positive form of change, and that just goes to show like there's sometimes a very stereotypical view of footballers, which is like deeply unfair and sort of inaccurate, you know. Mm-hmm. I saw some excerpt going around there. It was Sean O'Brien's book talking about like you know, how he was glad he went into rugby as opposed to football, because some stuff to do with respect and all this sort of stuff, all this nonsense, you know, like that as though like you one code makes you one more of a noble person than the other or something. It's nonsense, really. And Rashford certainly has been a really positive force for change. You can only applaud him, really.
Yeah, David, I know it was something you were keen to talk about as well.
Yeah, well, no, because it's just one of them, and it's only been touched on a little bit there. Like, and obviously Damien mentioned Michael Jordan. It's almost as if like elite sports people and are kind of saying, well, that's all you focus on. To be the best that you can be, you can't let anything else into your head or into your mind. All you should be focusing on is your job. And yeah, I suppose that is true to a degree, but I don't think you can, if you're someone like Marcus Rashford, who's grown up in an area of Manchester that is so deprived, like kind of when Trinkles, like Wittenshaw and stuff, like people don't know it. I think like part of that is based on, I remember that TV show Shameless and stuff, it's so stereotypical that people kind of peg all the people in that area as the one thing. But like, this is clearly a fella who has a social conscience, and for him it'd almost be more detrimental for him not to be doing what he's doing now and to just stick his head in the sand and say, well, you know, that's not what I'm about. I'm a footballer. I shouldn't have to be dealing with that. Like, that would probably maybe be doing him more harm to be doing that. This is something that he is driving himself personally. It's not something that people are looking at him and saying, oh, this would be good for PR. Like, what's going on in England and around the world at the moment, that's not what this is about. Like, if you're scrolling through his Twitter feed the other day, it was just like phenomenal, the activism that he's actually carrying out and helping to orchestrate. And I think it's gone beyond the whole thing of saying, oh, you know, if he has a couple of bad games, this is clearly what's causing it. Like, that's not the issue. Like, if he has a couple of bad games, it's because he's playing in the team that doesn't do enough for him, or he's not maybe just like delivering. I think the days now of expecting players to just shut up and do their job, and that's all they have to do to be the best they can be. Maybe it'll work for some, but for someone like Rashford, it's clear that he has to be standing up. He obviously feels like he was one of these lads who grew up not living off it, but needing that breakfast club of actually having breakfast before going into school. And for a lot of people, like, it's probably hard to fathom. It's hard to fathom that's what would be needed. But that's how a lot of people have to get through their lives, and that's how young kids are surviving. And like, even this fact of it's even going back even before this, like, where I remember going to Goodison Park not so long ago, and there was like collections for like food banks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's great that fans are getting together and doing this, but how is that right in a society now where that's actually needed? You know, it's just incredible, and it's sickening, really, like, when you think about it. So, as what Dan was saying, I think it's just Rashford's applauded to be doing what he's doing, you know.
Mm-hmm. We are running out of time, guys. Damien, I'll give last word on this to you very quickly.
Look, it's obviously fantastic what he's doing, and you know, he's making the British government look bad. You know, that he's raising awareness on this, and I saw now yesterday he had a load of local restaurants in lots of cities donating food and things like that. And look, I mean, you can be pretty sure now that that he has put himself up there to be kind of shot at, and there's a lot of Tory-loving newspapers in the UK that will, you know, just waiting for him to make a misstep, and then they will come for him. At the minute, he's kind of flavour of the month, but the government don't like being made to look bad. So he's as soon as his performances dip, he'll be judged a little bit different, and it shouldn't be like that, by the way. It shouldn't be at all. You know, he should be applauded for what he's doing.
All right, Damien, Dan McDonnell of the Irish Independent, and David Snaid, football freelance writer. Thanks a million for joining us.
No problem.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dale.
Paddy Power. As much a part of Irish football as spending a 9-month loan spell at Preston North End.
The OTB Podcast Network with Pepsi Max, proud sponsor of the UEFA Champions League. For the love of it.